Well, that was fast, wasn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, October 20th. Good to have you with us. You can probably guess the lead story today. British Prime Minister Liz Truss resigned after just 6 weeks, which makes her the shortest-serving prime minister in British history. Truss's rapid fall from power came after she introduced what came to be known as Trussonomics, a plan that included cutting taxes for Britain's wealthiest and freezing corporate taxes, all to be paid for by more borrowing. Voters and, just as importantly, investors revolted. The pound sank, borrowing costs shot up, and here we are. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard joins me now from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Amy.
So Liz Truss lasted, what, 45 days? Is this departure about politics or economics?
Well, it's a bit of both, really. But, I mean, the proximate cause certainly is economic. It was last month's absolutely disastrous mini-budget, as she called it, with its unfunded tax cuts. That's tax cuts to be paid for by government borrowing. It spooked the market, sent the pound plunging, government borrowing costs spiralling upwards, and led to higher mortgages. This has massively undermined the Truss government, its credibility, and gave the opposition, Labour Party, a 30-point lead in the opinion polls. That did not make Truss popular with the Conservative Party.
So she, of course, tried to recover. She fired her finance chief last week, installed a new one who reversed those mini-budget measures. That wasn't enough?
It certainly steadied the ship. I mean, financial markets have certainly been calmer, but the repercussions of the mini-budget have continued. The new finance chief tried yesterday to pressure the interior minister here, or home secretary, as we call her, to relax her planned crackdown on immigration. She refused, and yesterday she was forced out of office, the second cabinet office to be vacated within a week. Mm. Also yesterday, there was a parliamentary rebellion among Truss's lawmakers over the issue of fracking. Truss wanted to restart fracking, again, to promote growth. This led to chaotic scenes in Parliament, and that further undermined Truss's authority and credibility.
Mm. It was just too much to overcome. So what happens now? The Conservatives will have to install a new leader. How long could that take? And any ideas who it might be?
Well, the party says they're going to do it within a week, which is extraordinary. Wow. Because the last leadership election took more than 2 months. Difficult to forecast anything in this febrile atmosphere. But the favourite to win the leadership and to become the next Prime Minister of the UK is Rishi Sunak, former finance chief.
And given the power the markets seem to have over the political situation right now, would they find that reassuring?
Well, they should do. He is a former Goldman Sachs man. He understands markets. But there's another moment of truth and potential crisis for this beleaguered government looming. The new finance chief is scheduled to unveil the full plan for reversing the Truss mini-budget at the end of the month. That's almost certainly going to involve cuts in public spending or tax hikes, or most likely both. That won't be popular. And, you know, Amy, the omens are not good. The finance chief is scheduled to make his statement on October the 31st, Halloween.
Spooky. All right. Stephen Beard, our man in London, covering the turmoil there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
On Wall Street today, nothing quite so dramatic. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The fun part about corporate earnings season, okay, fun for some of us, is getting a peek into how business leaders are thinking about the economic forces we all deal with, like inflation. This week, we've had some insight into the dilemma big consumer products companies face when making decisions about prices. Procter & Gamble, maker of Tide laundry detergent, Bounty paper towels, and Crest toothpaste, reported that it raised prices 9% on average last quarter. Nestle, which sells Cheerios, Hot Pockets, and those little Nespresso coffee pods, said prices were up 7.5% on average. But those price increases aren't across the board. Marketplace's Justin Ho did some comparison shopping for us.
Part of a company's decision to raise prices comes down to what it's paying for raw materials. Linda Montag at Moody's says some raw materials have gotten more expensive than others.
Some of the cooking oils that are used in the food industry and also in the cosmetic industry, you know, some of those are up 200, 300, 400%, while other things are up, you know, in the mid-teens as a percent.
It also depends on how many raw inputs it takes to make a product. Montag says a bag of coffee, for example, has fewer than a frozen meal.
In that frozen meal, you may have, you know, potatoes, you may have corn, you may have a protein. You've got a tray that might be resin or it might be fiberboard. You've got an outside package.
And the prices of all of those things have been changing at different rates. Then there's the matter of competition. When a product's up against private label brands, its manufacturer has an incentive to keep prices lower or make its product better to justify higher prices, says Brittany Quatrochi, consumer staples analyst at Edward Jones.
If that branded product has some sort of performance element or taste element to it that is superior, you're more apt to be willing to pay that higher amount.
Companies can also decide not to change their prices, but instead make their packages smaller. Nicole DeHoratius is a professor at the University of Chicago.
You tend to just look at the face value of the good without doing the calculations to say, okay, am I paying, you know, $5 per ounce or $6 per ounce?
That's called shrinkflation. And DeHoratius says it's a hidden way to change prices without causing as much sticker shock. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Sticking with inflation, the Biden administration said this week it will release another 15 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in an ongoing effort to keep gasoline prices in check. But something else in the announcement caught the eye of our energy reporter, Andy Euler, a note about the price the government will pay producers when it decides to replenish that oil. Here's Andy.
The White House says it plans to buy oil to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR, at between $67 and $72 per barrel. It's about 20 bucks less than today's price. Bob McNally, president of the consultancy Rapidan Energy Group, says that's essentially a price floor. And the message behind that is clear.
Drillers, please keep drilling and invest.
$70 is just about the break-even point for most onshore U.S. oil producers, so that number's probably not a coincidence. And while rig count in the U.S. has been rising, Kaushik Dabe at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy says he's a bit dubious that a price guarantee will do much to incentivize more activity.
The oil and gas companies haven't been investing in this business, despite the fact that prices have been much, much higher than this.
He says there are a number of reasons the industry has been reluctant to drill. For one, investors on Wall Street have been vehement about capital discipline. And Eleanor Wald, president of Transversal Consulting, says beyond access to cash, oil companies are dealing with many more challenges.
It's supply chain issues. It's lack of steel and steel tariffs. It's labor costs. It's finding labor. It's emissions regulations.
Now, in terms of this particular policy measure, Bob McNally at Rapidan Energy says there's a question about how much the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve at 700 million barrels of storage can affect such a large global market.
I urge them to be cautious about communicating to the market that they want to create a price floor. You know, the SPR is a tool that can be used to stabilize or affect even global prices of oil.
A larger SPR release earlier this year only had a modest effect on global oil prices. McNally says OPEC Plus actually has much more power than we do in determining prices. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We are now less than three nail-biting weeks away from the midterm elections. And this year, big campaign money is pouring into state-level races. Open Secrets, a nonprofit group that tracks money in politics, projects spending at the state level this year will top $7 billion, a new record. Some of that money is going to candidates for previously lower-profile government jobs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Maybe you never used to pay much attention to who the Secretary of State in your home state was, but these days, more voters are realizing Secretaries of State have an important job.
They set the broad parameters for how elections are to be run, the basic rules about how ballots are cast and counted.
Matt Bennett heads Third Way, a center-left think tank. He says in most states, the Secretary of State also certifies the election. Fred Wertheimer, president of Democracy 21, says along with voters, campaign donors are also realizing what state attorneys general can do.
They can bring lawsuits following an election to challenge the results.
More than half the state attorneys general are up for election next month. Open Secrets expects them to raise in the ballpark of $200 million for the midterms. That's about on par with two other big years, 2010 and 2018. But Secretary of State candidates could set a new record. Open Secrets researcher Sarah Briner says there are about two dozen Republican attorney general and Secretary of State candidates who still haven't accepted the results of the 2020 presidential election.
In the states that really are likely to make the difference, election deniers are raising a lot of money.
She's talking about swing states, including Arizona and Nevada. In Arizona alone, Open Secrets estimates the Secretary of State candidates could raise $6 million. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I don't want to be in a place mentally where I'm starting to have to question doctors.
Yeah, not a good place to be. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 90 points, 0.3%, to close at 30,333. The NASDAQ lost 65 points to finish down 0.6% at 10,614. And the S&P 500 was down 29 points, 0.8%, and at 36.65. See, not so dramatic. AT&T blew past analysts' expectations with its third quarter results. The telecom giant added more wireless customers than expected, and its wireless revenues rose more than 5%. Shares in AT&T dialed up almost 7.75%. Seems like we should do some European numbers, eh? Britain's FTSE added more than 0.25%. France's CAC 40 rose 0.75%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.23%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Several cities across America with majority Black populations have been facing water crises. Places like Jackson and Baltimore, where aging infrastructure has led to contaminated drinking water. Now add the town of Duquesne, Pennsylvania to the list. Residents are paying more for water they say is unsafe, and many low-income people face shutoffs because they can't pay the bills. Private companies say they offer a solution. But at what price? Catherine Smith wrote about it as a reporting fellow at the Pulitzer Center. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me about Duquesne, Pennsylvania, and what's happening with the water there.
So Duquesne, Pennsylvania is a majority Black city. It's nestled in the foothills outside of Pittsburgh. They have poor water quality, poor air quality. It's only about 5,000 people, and it's really been overlooked by some of the authorities in the area. A lot of people in town, they don't trust their water. It comes out cloudy for a lot of residents. It smells funny. It tastes funny. The city says the water is safe to drink, but people just don't trust it. One resident I talked to said that now he travels out outside of the city borders to a natural spring, and he collects his drinking water from a spring because the water tastes so bad at his house.
Wow.
Also, the town doesn't have a lot of money for infrastructure improvements. And so there's a lot of problems with the town's water system, and it doesn't really have the money to fix it because it's a very financially distressed city that's losing population.
And so the water quality has gone down, but water bills are going up at the same time, right?
Yeah, and that's something that's happening all over the United States. And in a city like Duquesne, where you have a high percentage of people who are very low income, rising water bills are going to hit them really hard and really fast. And so people who have, you know, more disposable income aren't going to feel those increases as hard. And in a city like Duquesne, when you already have poor water quality and you're being forced to pay more and more every year, people are going to start to look at that money and say, no, wait a minute, this doesn't seem fair. This doesn't seem right. What's going on here, basically? And the city, because the city doesn't have a lot of money to fix the water infrastructure, it may be considering a sale to one of the large private water companies in the area.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in a bit. But it's hard not to notice that Duquesne is yet another example of a majority Black community dealing with this issue. I mean, we've seen this in Flint, Michigan, Jackson, Mississippi, here in Baltimore, where I am. What do you make of this pattern?
I mean, I think it's cities like Jackson, like Duquesne, like Flint, they've suffered from historic disinvestment in their water infrastructure, like a lot of cities have. And these cities have struggled to get funding in recent years. They've deferred maintenance for a very long time. And, you know, all the problems with their water systems are coming home to roost kind of all at the same time. And cities that don't have a lot of money are going to have worse problems with their water system. It's going to hit them faster and harder than cities that have more money that can maybe, you know, put Band-Aid fixes on their water systems more easily. So like in Duquesne, you know, you're seeing people with really water that they say is undrinkable, and there's just really not a lot the city can do to fix it without a huge influx of money.
What is driving privatization from the municipal government perspective? Is it really just they can't afford to upkeep this infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. Yeah, it's you know, city governments all over the country are having trouble maintaining their water systems. It's incredibly expensive. It requires a lot of expertise. And most city governments just can't handle the financial burden. And a city like Duquesne, where a high proportion of their residents are in poverty, the city's basically broke. They just cannot shoulder a burden like that. And so, you know, a private water company like American Water Works, they'll swoop in with a huge offer of money. It looks very appealing. You know, it can help the city fund their police pensions, keep their lights on in City Hall. But at the end of the day, it usually leads to higher water bills for customers. Water bills tend to only run in one direction. They go up. They don't come back down.
So these companies are charging more, but are they providing better service?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. In a city like Duquesne, where the public water service is really not serving the people, a private water system may be the better option for them if they can't afford to fix their municipal infrastructure. But that just means that residents are going to be paying a lot more money. So it's, you know, it's a really tough decision that the town is weighing. I think in other cities, privatization doesn't necessarily mean better service, but it could be a ticket for a city that's really strapped for money.
Catherine Smith wrote about Duquesne, Pennsylvania, and the privatization of water with the Pulitzer Center.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. When should patients who go to the ER be admitted to the hospital? And what happens when profit enters that equation? It's a question being raised about how one of the biggest hospital companies in the country has handled some patient care. Hospitals can make more money when they admit people, and some have had to pay settlements over keeping patients when they should have been sent home. Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville has that story.
Jennifer Smithfield was admitted to the hospital after visiting a local emergency room on a Sunday afternoon. Now she's second-guessing her three-day stay in February.
I didn't think, even though I did not feel well, I didn't feel like it was bad enough to be hospitalized, especially not multiple days.
Smithfield was still weak and having some trouble breathing after 10 days with COVID. It was the weekend, and so her primary care physician suggested going to the emergency department. She chose HCA's flagship medical center near its headquarters in Nashville, where she has a long history as a patient. She was put on low-flow oxygen and admitted, but she says she wasn't hooked up to any monitors until the next morning, which made her think she couldn't be in that bad a shape. Even her personal doctor was texting, asking why they admitted her. According to a 2018 study, fewer than one in five ER patients is admitted these days. Smithfield didn't leave until Wednesday.
I've put a phenomenal amount of trust in doctors over the last decade. I don't want to be in a place mentally where I'm starting to have to question doctors.
There's a big difference between being kept in the ER for observation, even overnight, and being fully admitted as an inpatient, especially the cost. Smithfield racked up $40,000 in charges, $6,000 out of pocket. She's now disputing the bill after learning others have accused HCA of being quick to admit. Ken Nolan is an attorney from Fort Lauderdale who has successfully represented healthcare workers who file lawsuits over fraudulent hospital admissions.
Why these cases arise involves the push-pull between the incentive of the business side of healthcare, between providing just enough services versus overutilization.
In suburban Miami, Dr. Camilo Ruiz filed a whistleblower lawsuit accusing HCA of having a de facto quota system. He said supervisors hounded him with warnings and even threatened his job unless he started admitting more patients to meet his targets. Attorneys used Medicare data to show HCA hospitals nationwide are increasingly admitting patients for low-level maladies like nausea and back pain, while non-HCA hospitals are going the opposite direction. The case was filed in 2018, but the government decided not to take on the investigation, so Ruiz chose not to pursue it on his own. His attorneys and the Department of Justice declined to comment. Jacob Tubbs is an attorney in Birmingham who works on whistleblower cases. He says hospital admissions fraud is tough, even for federal prosecutors.
What we are going to have to ultimately prove, or the United States government is going to have to prove using our whistleblower, is that the medical care was objectively unnecessary. And what you're talking about really is a subjective standard.
But now the data from the closed HCA whistleblower case is having a second life. A national labor union, which represents thousands of hospital workers, has previously challenged hospital systems on admissions fraud. A report from the Service Employees International Union inspired Representative Bill Pascrell, a New Jersey Democrat who chairs a congressional oversight subcommittee, to launch an inquiry into HCA and ask U.S. Health and Human Services officials to investigate. Joseph Lyons is an SEIU researcher who estimates the government paid HCA $1.8 billion for unnecessary care over the last decade.
If you have a system the size of HCA seeming so brazen with this, this should be looked at by anyone who has authority over Medicare.
HCA says its doctors are motivated only by their medical judgment and that no company policies require admitting patients. The company has also questioned the motives of the SEIU, which represents many of its workers. Other smaller for-profit health systems have settled cases involving hospital admissions for $100 million or more. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. If you're looking to leave your stressful job, how about a dose of affirmation from the nation's top doctor? Today, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy called out toxic workplaces as a health hazard. In guidance issued today, the Surgeon General said long hours, heavy workloads, and limited autonomy can cause chronic stress, disrupt sleep, and damage both physical and mental health. How do you know if your workplace is toxic? Research points to five words as pretty good indicators: disrespectful, non-inclusive, unethical, cutthroat, and abusive. And here's your moment of economic context. Yesterday, I told you about the decline in new home construction last month. Today, we learned sales of existing homes fell, too, to the slowest pace in 10 years. That's from the National Association of Realtors. Prices also fell in September from the month before, but the median sale price was still more than 8% higher than this time last year. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.